good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding.
You're listening to episode 591 of Unwelcome Guests, Anima Mundi. I'm Robin Upton. A somewhat cosmic show for you this week, looking at life, the universe and everything, particularly whether the world is just a bunch of stuff that humans can move around as best they see fit, or is there a higher order? Is there something at work that we can ignore only at our peril? Well, given the various ecological disasters which humans have wrought on planet Earth in the name of progress, I think you could be forgiven for hoping that there is a higher power at work, that there is some structure, perhaps some meaning, and whether you call this God, or Gaia, or some other name that suits you, our show this week starts with a radio adaptation of the film Anima Mundi, which explores that contention with a range of speakers focusing on permaculture as a way of living lightly and respectfully on the planet, much as we might do if our consciousness shifted and people understood that they were in fact living inside a giant life form. If people were not only intellectually but emotionally and acutely aware of the interconnectedness not only of one another but of all living processes on planet Earth. And this will continue until our second hour, then we're going to hear from Wendell Berry, and to conclude, a snippet from our continuing reading of David Graeber's Debt, the first 5,000 years.
Classical economics, that's the real religion of this age, and this is the most pious religion that the world has ever known, with people worshipping the Sabbath lasting 5 days a week in great skyscraping, earth-destroying buildings and malls, and its huge power comes from the fact that it's not even recognized to be a religious phenomenon. It supposes itself to be secular, but in fact it's a very insidious religion and is consuming the earth with a fervor that the Easter Islanders could only have dreamed of.
Each day, as thousands of persons visit the chain stores in their neighborhoods, their journey carries them past powerful messages advantageously placed on nearby poster panels. At night, as they visit their favorite movie houses, and in the day, while going to and from the neighborhood drugstores and centrally located supermarkets, the local service stations, or to work in any one of the busy industrial centers, these hundreds of thousands of buyers.
From that perspective, advertising becomes religious education, and it's education, it's educating people to believe that they need certain things in order to feel fulfilled and abundant, and it's just bullshit. Because in the end, I think what's going to save us is to discover a spirituality and a consciousness that doesn't need to sacrifice anything in order to live lightly on the planet. It's just that we don't want that shit any longer because we've got the real thing.
But the inhabitants of planet Earth do not always welcome culture changes. There is often a resistance to anything different from the habits of the past.
Julie, when I was a girl, we wouldn't have been caught dead with no more clothes on than that. My stars, what are our young people coming to these days?
Change of any kind is often opposed by vested interests.
We just can't do it, Jim. We've got too much tied up in present equipment.
I am convinced that this proposal would be extremely expensive and very uncertain of success.
David Holmgren, co-founder of Permaculture.
We're definitely in a trap. We're in a systemic trap, which is not just a trap by evil people who sort of planned this from the beginning, but it's actually a systemic trap. It's a trap of structural addiction where the system can't stop, because if it stops, the consequences are horrific. But if it goes on, the consequences are horrific.
Michael Reynolds, Earthship Pioneer.
The way we have been living is over. And that means our rules and our regulations are over. All of our rules and our regulations are relative to stick frame houses that you pump heat into, and the sewage and water regulations are all about endless amounts of energy and water, wasteful methods of living. Those days are over due to population explosion and climate change and dwindling resources. Put all three of those together. You know, I don't care whether you call it global warming or whether people caused it or not. I'm not into any of that argument. I'm just saying I'm into the unarguable aspects.
Whether it is things are caused by natural cycles or whether they're caused by human cycles, we must get ready for a world that is much less perfect for the current systems. The last 10,000 years has been a very stable climatic period, and that's actually the biggest argument for why agriculture developed and the spread of humanity and the development of civilization, because we had a stable climate. The evidence of the last 10 ice ages over the last million years is that interglacial period averages 10,000 years. So we are due for another ice age. How would industrial society cope with not the mini ice age of the medieval period, but a full ice age? And what amazes me is that the climate change orthodoxy doesn't ever challenge the skeptics on that. So how would we design the world if we are facing this horrendous volatility in climate caused by nature?
There is evidence that carbon dioxide produced by man may be altering the climate by changing Earth's energy balance. Some call it the greenhouse effect.
You mentioned global warming. See, it's very interesting the way that's portrayed in the media. It's portrayed as if there's two sides. You know, we have to be objective, so 50% for each. One side is like 99% of scientists. The other side is Rush Limbaugh, Sarah Palin, Jim Inhofe, and you know, three guys that they kind of contrarians in the science community. So we give them equal time, and then how's the ordinary citizen going to figure it out? Actually, the New York Times had a front page story a couple of days ago about the very interesting controversy that's taking place between climate scientists and what they called meteorologists, the people who appear on television to tell you whether it's going to rain tomorrow. And they differ. So how's the ordinary citizen going to figure it out?
A 2009 poll found 36% of Americans believed in man-made global warming.
First of all, it should be pointed out that there's actually three sides. There's not two. There's the mainstream scientific consensus, and there's two groups of denialists. One of them is the one that's given equal time, you know, Senator Inhofe, Rush Limbaugh. But there's another one, which is very significant. Major groups of scientists who think that the mainstream analyses are nowhere near grave enough. It's very serious work. I mean, MIT just came out with a big study, their scientists, saying the reality is far worse than what's predicted. Well, they're not part of the debate. Okay. So what's the ordinary citizen going to do? Well, he's not going to become a climate scientist. But, you know, the choices in this case are so transparent that it doesn't take a lot of work to figure it out. I mean, what's the chances that the overwhelming majority of climate scientists from all over the place, either the ones who say it's very grave or the others who say it's even worse than you claim, what are the probability that they're wrong and Rush Limbaugh's right? You know, I mean, it's not a hard decision. You don't have to be an expert.
Dr. Stephen Harding, Guyan ecologist.
I don't think we should think, when is it going to happen? It's happening. We're already losing vast amounts of biodiversity. It's actually happening. The permafrost is already beginning to release methane. We're losing the Arctic sea ice exponentially fast, shockingly fast. I mean, this last summer we lost a vast extent of sea ice. Already the Northwest Passage is more or less opened up, and already the oil companies are moving in to try and exploit oil reserves there, which is the ultimate irony. So we're at the beginning of what could become an abrupt change. I mean, many of the scientists involved in this field no longer think of gradual climate change, but of abrupt changes, you know, from one state to another. So we could tip into a warm state very, very quickly. Say within 8 to 10 years, we could begin to see very severe changes. So we have to act now. There's no other option but to act right now, immediately.
And that means that we have to develop simpler ways of doing things, more resilient ways of doing things. And the whole science of resilience actually looks like a list of permaculture design principles. We have to make general systems with lots of loose connections, great diversity, not rigid hierarchical structures, but lots of flexibility. That's what the science of resilience is telling us, that that's what nature does when it's got uncertainty and radical change. That's how it survives, and that's how human systems have survived. So what that really means is our centralized, highly efficient industrial machine actually falls over when we get this unstable climate patterns. So that means we have to redesign that, even if the climate change is not caused by us. And so this really sidesteps the whole debate about whether it's caused by people or not. Now, if that was the case, you would say, well, you wouldn't focus so much on carbon, but you'd still do all the same things, which actually involves using less fossil fuel, simplifying society, less mobility, more local economy, more permaculture type agriculture rather than large scale broad acre agriculture, which all would involve using less fossil fuel, which all would involve less carbon emissions. So it's all the same thing.
A 100 years ago, smokestacks were a proud symbol of industrial progress. They meant jobs for the people, products in the stores. Refuse from a plant was a local problem, disfiguring only one tiny bit of land, water, or air. It seemed a small price to pay for more jobs, higher salaries, a rapidly improved standard of living. Scum in the river, but a chicken in the pot every Sunday. A stench in the air, but a car in the garage. Jacob Heath tries to stay calm as he faces a storm caused by pollution. Never before had this been so directly observed. On the basis of the satellite pictures, the companies will be ordered to stop pollution from their smokestacks. In this way, satellites are providing more accurate and reliable weather information by helping to stop inadvertent weather modification.
In order to regulate her temperature, Gaia has had to extract carbon dioxide from the atmosphere to compensate for the increasing brightness of the sun over geological time. If she hadn't done this, the Earth would be by now far too hot for life. And she's put the carbon in various places. It's as if she's trying to put the carbon in these vaults where it can be safely locked away out of the atmosphere. So the biggest is chalk and limestone. The second biggest is organic material dispersed through sedimentary rocks. And the fossil fuels is quite a tiny amount of that compared to those two. What Guy has done is managed to bring down the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to levels that are so low that plants can just about manage to live on it. Because, as you know, carbon dioxide, carbon, is a food for plants. It's a gaseous food that they take in through little pores underneath their leaves, right? It's a gaseous food. Gaia has managed to keep the CO2, bring it down as low as she possibly can without killing off the plants, in the face of a very bright sun. So if we then open up one of those vaults, take out stored carbon from the Earth's crust and burn it, we then return carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, and we make things much too hot. You could say it's good for the plants in the short term, which it probably is in the short term, but it makes the whole of Gaia so hot that it's a terrible danger for the whole biosphere.
How could the burning of this relatively small amount of carbon compared with the amount of carbon cycling in the biosphere through plants and other forms have such a big impact on the climate? And if we understood the real power of fossil fuels, if we measured it in ways like using energy accounting, and we looked at the total budget of the Gaian system as it has been evolved over the last 4,000 million years, there's been two sources of energy, primary energy, that have allowed the development of the living planet. One is the solar energy, and one is the heat being released by the residual radioactivity of the Earth. Supposedly, the sun energy from the sun is huge, and the energy from that inside bit is not much. But when you evaluate them using the energy methodology, you recognise that this internal energy of the Earth is actually much more concentrated energy. And when properly re-evaluated, they are equal. So the energy from Father Sky and the energy from Mother Earth are actually the equal power. One extra source of significant energy, the energy from Sister Moon, the moon tide, adds a significant amount to that. Four from the Sun, four from the Earth, 1.5 from the moon tide. 9.5 units is the total energy that created this whole system over the last 4,000 million years. As a byproduct of that, in the highly productive periods, fossil fuels were created as a little piggy bank, storing away some of that. We have dug that out of the ground and put that into the atmosphere, and the value of that fossil fuels using that same methodology is another 11 units on top of the 9.5. So we have doubled the power flow in the Earth. Should that change the climate? Totally different set of numbers. Anyone can see that a system that's 4,000 million years old has been running on 9.5 and has suddenly got a shot of an extra 11 is going to change big time. It's like the system's on steroids. And so that sort of way of evaluating things says, yeah, that little bit of carbon dioxide we've put into the atmosphere as a result of burning this immensely potent stuff is very, very powerful. And suddenly all the change in the world, the whole change in the of forest to agriculture, the development of cities, this huge explosion of human population, makes sense.
In the morning, in any community, men, women and children leave their homes. They walk, they ride in automobiles, in streetcars, in buses, in railroad trains, in rapid transit systems. They are on the move. And as they move, they do numerous things. They work, they play, they study, and most important of all, they buy. Daily, this great human tide flows into offices, into factories, into stores, into schools, into churches. The people who make up these markets are going places. This daily habitual movement of the buying power of the market is commonly referred to as traffic.
Basically, when you have a continually growing system with exponential growth, eventually that system runs into limits. And those limits are both the limits of the resources that sustain it and the limits of sinks where you dump all the stuff. And we are running into the two biggest limits in climate change, and we are reaching the limits for the rate of how fast we can dig things out of the ground. That from now on, the amount and the quality of what we can dig out of the ground gets less, not more. And of course, the big one in that is oil, because oil is so much of the global energy use, is this one resource, and it is of such high quality energy that can be used for so many things. It's really the biggest single factor that's created the cities of the world. It's created industrial agriculture. It's created the technology and created towards 7 billion people.
Mike Ruppert, author.
I saw clearly that there was a connection between the events following 9/11, the U.S. occupation of Iraq to seize its oil supplies, the second largest known reserves on the planet, peak oil, and the fact that the U.S. government was clearly aware for a long time that we were going to be facing a situation like we're facing now, both economically and from an energy standpoint. There's a 96% correlation between greenhouse gas emission and GDP growth. Ipso facto, if you want to have GDP growth after a collapse, you must burn oil to do it. There is nothing that will replace the edifice built by fossil fuels anywhere. Now, we have picked all the low-hanging fruit, obviously. We are now having a 70,000-barrel-a-day leak from the Deepwater Horizon well, which was a bridge too far, the ultimate reach off the tree limb to get that piece of fruit, and we've fallen off, and we don't have the technology. Man's greed for energy and consumption and infinite growth has led us to this point.
Barack Obama, U.S. President, speaks in March 2010.
Some of the press may be wondering why we are announcing offshore drilling in a hangar at Andrews Air Force Base. Well, if there's any doubt about the leadership that our military is showing, you just need to look at this F-18 fighter and the light armored vehicle behind me. The Army and Marine Corps have been testing this vehicle on a mixture of biofuels, and this Navy fighter jet, appropriately called the Green Hornet, will be flown for the first time in just a few days on Earth Day. Now, the Pentagon isn't seeking these alternative fuels just to protect our environment. They're pursuing these homegrown energy sources to protect our national security.
And we're totally screwed. And we are totally screwed because no action was taken to prepare for it in advance of peak oil. Because Wall Street demands infinite growth, and any acknowledgement of peak oil would have devastated share values on Wall Street. It would have brought an end to the consumer economy. So the issue is not the oil companies making profits. The issue is that there cannot be economic growth without energy.
Peak oil equals peak money.
One of the things that's misunderstood is that the world oil price getting over $60 a barrel and then over $100 a barrel and then getting to almost $150 was actually a major factor in producing this largest recession since the Great Depression. All of the last recessions since the end of the Second World War have been preceded by an energy price spike.
By the time we're into September and October of 2008, we are well into the economic collapse, which began when oil prices peaked at $147 a barrel. I don't think anybody disputes that that was the trigger for the first stage of the collapse of human industrial civilization. And it was very clear to me then that we had passed, if you will, a watershed moment in human history then. That there was no coming back, and that no amount of bailouts or cooked books or printed money was going to reverse the inevitable collapse of human industrial civilization and a die-off of what might be ultimately proved to be 3, 4, maybe 5 billion people.
Dr. Christine James speaks on psychology.
If you or I were to go out and form a company and do pyramid selling, we'd basically be acting against the law. It's illegal. But capitalism does that very thing, and in doing that, it exploits people, it harms people, it causes wars, it causes genocides, it causes poverty across the world. And If we're really going to change the world, we have to change capitalism. And if we're going to change capitalism, we have to change the consciousness that created capitalism.
The degree to which we can separate ourselves from that trap, I think, depends on the degree to which we can build the parallel economy, the economy of the household, the economy of the community, that doesn't depend on this debt-based money system. The economies of exchange, to do with very simple things, the gift economy, the barter economy, and slightly more sophisticated, but very simple versions of the money economy, like let's trading systems, but are not linked to the national currencies that are linked to this fake notions of wealth and the perpetual need to grow. The idea that the growth of money through interest is some arbitrary thing that can just be determined, well, natural systems only grow at a maximum of about 5% per annum. So anything that's actually dependent on nature, that's the absolute limit that you could have a money system grow at.
Money is useless without energy. One can't eat money. Money only is a symbol representing the ability to do work, which energy really is. So you can print all the money you want to, you can't eat it, nor can you put it in your gas tank.
What it comes down to is that the oil industry has to please Mrs. Martin and millions just like her. Already today, she's used some 87 petroleum products, including the plastic bacon wrapper and the wax of the milk carton. She'll top 100 before the day is over. Mrs. Martin is the customer, and the customer is the boss of the oil industry.
You can see how energy is an important commodity in the economy, but it's more than that. It's actually the thing that makes everything else possible. And it's the same in nature. Actually, a natural system cannot operate without a net source of energy. And what that really means is the system gets more energy out of its energy harvesting activities than it put into it. So it's no good for a predator like a fox to spend more metabolic energy running after rabbits than it gets back from eating the rabbits, because it will soon be dead. That would be a net energy loss. It must get more energy from catching the rabbit than it took to get the rabbit. As we've now got to the point of peak oil, the energy return on the energy we invest in things like oil wells is much, much less than it used to be. Now, what that means is the oil industry is growing larger and larger, employing more people, using more complex knowledge and technology. But the amount of wealth that is left over for society as a proportion is getting less. So this energy return on energy investment is very, very important. And that we can see there's some renewable energies that have a relatively good return on investment, like wind power. And we can see some so-called renewable energies like corn ethanol that maybe have no net energy return at all.
The energy returned on energy invested worldwide was about 100 to 1 when oil started, so the first barrel of energy used gained 100 barrels of oil. It's now down to 10 to 1. In the case of coal, it's 3 to 1, and tar sands is about 2 to 1. Nuclear is estimated at about 2 to 1, including waste disposal and decommissioning. Wind is 25 to 1, and photovoltaic cells are about 10 to 1.
If we just do the simple calculation and said, well, what if all the world's cars were running on biofuels? We'd need more land than all of the agricultural land we currently have, and then we'd have a small problem of where we get our sandwiches from.
biofuels, I think it's a little bit like emissions trading schemes, that anything to allow business as usual to go on and not to have to bite the bullet and to recognise that, what did Lennon Cohen say? It's not going any further. It's all over now. Do you know, that whole game is over. Yeah. And the sooner that we just make a deep sigh and accept it, the more of the resources are going to be available to us to actually do the transition to a sustainable future.
This is very much the permaculture argument, that the behaviour change and simple retrofitting of what we've got is better than trying to spin the machine faster. If we say we're going to rev up the machine to create a whole new renewable version of what we've got, then I think that was more likely to drive us over the cliff. And everyone thinks that a very low energy future means a return to the caves, but cavemen didn't have stainless steel to make tools out of. And yet future generations, no matter how severe the energy descent, will have littered around the landscape for millennia into the future stainless steel. What a fantastic thing. And, you know, okay, that's the extreme, but right at the moment, we can go and get stainless steel sinks that are being thrown out at the rubbish tips and use them to make other very valuable, durable things. And that's all challenging our creativity, our use of skills. And there's a million things like that that we see everywhere in permaculture projects, this creative reuse and recycling.
Michael Reynolds speaks on Earthships.
When you use an already made material for a secondary use, you're obviously saving the energy that it would take to manufacture and ship a conventional building material. But that's not the end of it. You're also saving the money that it would take to get rid of the garbage. I was taking an engineer, a gearhead, a pragmatic person through an Earthship. And he was going through it and he saw it all and he didn't say anything. It was quiet. And then after I pretty much was wrapping up the whole thing, he just blurted out. He said, "What the world needs is 1 billion of these right now." And that was the best thing anybody had ever said. The first thing I would say for people to do in trying to comprehend this is be advised that it's not a house. That's why we call them Earthships. It is something that we say will sail on the seas of tomorrow, basically, without a nuclear power plant. It's not like living in, you know, some teepee out in New Mexico. It's like you have everything: flat screen TV, high speed internet. You have all the goodies, and it can be done in a carbon neutral situation. That is not the problem. That's the fun part, and evolving that is fun. But the other aspect of it is our rules and our regulations simply won't let us do it. You know, they're about things that aren't pertinent anymore.
In spite of such opposition, cultures are always changing. New ways of doing and of thinking gradually take hold. But the basic mores on which each culture is built change very slowly.
The trouble is that for it to hit hard enough, for everyone to wake up, it might be too late to do anything about it. And so I'm hoping that there might be some way for people to wake up short of the oil actually running out and the food no longer being in the supermarkets and so on. I don't think that the people that are growing organic food are going to survive in that kind of a scenario.
David Holmgren speaks on relocalizing.
The reality is, if we don't relocalize our food system over the next decade, you or your children will be lining up with your ration ticket at Coles with your government allocation of what you can get through the centralised food system. Because that food system is going down. That food system in 50 years will not exist, because the energy that drives that central agricultural system
not just in the production, but in the transport, in the processing, in the centralized logistics, in the huge central marketing domination that everyone's freaked out about at the moment by Woolworths and Coles domination. All of that system is extremely dependent on cheap energy. And the era of cheap energy is coming to an end.
There are people who want to go back to the bar who don't believe it, who call us doomers. There are people who are deer in the headlights, who are panicked, who cannot process a thought. But thank God there are many, many hundreds of thousands and millions of people, I would say, in the United States alone, who get it, who are actively building lifeboats now. And a lifeboat is something sustainable that's local, first and foremost, where your food is grown close to where you live. That's the foremost issue right now.
Adam Grubb, Permablitzer.
Permablitz is an initiative that started in Melbourne where we come together and we help transform someone's backyard so they're growing more food. And it's a completely volunteer-based thing. Each Permablitz has permaculture design informing it, and that design is explained to you at the beginning of the day. That means everybody that comes doesn't just learn, but they become autonomous agents a bit, and heaps easier if you're facilitating one of these things. Lots of problem solving happens. A lot of times we're transforming, you know, blank slate backyards, so we're turning, you know, lawn to lunch, and it's radical transformation in a day, and it's great to be a part of, and you learn through doing, hands-on.
And it's sort of, we think of it as a sort of a way of, or a medium that the mainstream can sort of ease themselves into getting a feel for what permaculture is about. You can come along to a blitz with no qualifications, there's no expectations, you meet people, you have fun, you learn a bit, and so on, and before you know it, you're starting to think about having one yourself and learning more and more about permaculture. There's some theorists that say the suburbs are the greatest misallocation of resources in human history. And then there's others that are a bit more positive, like David Hongren, who points out that the suburbs are not only where people are, but where a lot of resources are. You've got a lot of infrastructure, you've got pipes bringing resources in and out. And there's actually enormous scope, especially in the quarter acre properties where you've still got a bit of yard to play with, for food production. There's a lot of organic material that can be composted, so you can build soils. There's a lot of hard surfaces, a lot of roads and paths and roofs, so you've got the water there, you've got the nutrients, you've got the people, and there's enormous scope for massively increasing the amount of food and other needs that we produce in the suburbs.
There's enough land in the suburbs to provide for most of people's perishable food needs. The processing of doing that will save massive amounts of water, oil and other resources, and give huge numbers of people employment where they live and create local businesses.
Vandana Shiva speaks on philosophy.
The way I look at it, you know, the earth doesn't create unemployment. The earth is the most generous employer and job provider that you could imagine. Left into relationships with the earth, there's never a job that doesn't need to be done. Lack of work is a product of the marketplace, and the combination of the marketplace with technologies whose productivity is defined purely as efficiency if they get rid of people. What is the normal productivity analysis is output per unit input. Normal input should be resources. You take resources into account, you will go for ecological technologies. You go for resources, you will ensure sustainable technologies emerge because you will use fewer resources to meet more needs. But resources are never taken into account in productivity analysis. Labor is the only input that's taken into account. So by definition, a technology that creates unemployment is defined as more productive. But every technology that creates more unemployment also uses more resources. So all ecologically inefficient, labor-displacing, unemployment-creating technologies are the ones that grow as the efficiencies of industrialism and modern, you know, modern organizing of life. Gandhi pulled out the spinning wheel to fight the British Empire. And, you know, people used to laugh and say, ha, 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 with a piece of wood, how can you fight the worst of it? He says, the only way you can fight it, because you pull out a gun, they'll always have a bigger gun. But if they've already got the bigger machines and you can shift the system to the smaller one, you've already changed the whole logic. So the spinning wheel was designed to shift the ground, change the thinking. Change the thinking about power and powerlessness, about beauty, about aesthetics. Because what Gandhi did was shift aesthetics from thinking of the uniform machine-made cloth as beautiful to the uneven khadi and all its variations as having beauty. He shifted the thinking from how fast textiles could come out of a factory into how much resources they sucked out of the earth.
Things like the enormous amount of high quality land and water that is used for cotton production in the world, we could slash by half tomorrow and have no problem of shortage of clothing. So that in itself would free up so much capacity. Of course, the largest, most obvious one is the reallocation of the budgets and resources devoted to the military. So if we look at it from that point of view, we could start the pathway down and deal with supporting 7 billion people as long as we acknowledge, as the fossil fuels go down, as all of we start to draw on these things and use these enormous nest eggs that have been built up, the population has got to go down.
Well, I'm going to take the unusual step of interrupting this adaption because I have strong feelings on overpopulation, and I think it's helpful to think about some of the contradictions. Earlier on, the hope was expressed, post-peak oil, humanity will realize, yeah, all those material goods really weren't where it's at. They didn't give us the better quality of life that we were seeking for. That was just what we were told by the advertisements. Given that people in the so-called developed countries consume often an order of magnitude or even more natural resources than those in countries like Bangladesh, which is actually the majority of the world, what's the sense in talking about having an overpopulation problem? Some people will come out and say, well, humanity's population, because of the fossil fuel thing, when that goes down, population has to go down. We have a population problem. I would say, no, it's a behavior problem. As people in so-called rich countries are used to consuming hugely more natural resources than can be sustained. If that behavior is changed, we don't have a population problem at all. As Vandana Shiva goes on to say here, it's about how people behave. If humanity is consistent upon consuming all the resources available and not giving back, it doesn't matter how many people we've got, that's too many. If humanity is focused on building a sustainable planet for all, then I'm convinced we can support a lot of people, and a lot more than we have now. People in developed countries so often frame this as an overpopulation problem, which puts the emphasis on who's got the large numbers, countries like Bangladesh. Looking instead at behavior, I think is a very empowering thing, because it puts the emphasis back on you, the individual. How do you live your life? Are you a drain on the local environment, or are you building it up? The essential truth that I think governments and many large organizations would like to hide from you is that actually that is what it comes down to, and that you do have a choice about how you behave. And yes, the film is excellent in making the case that the large institutions have a set of rules which prohibit you from being a productive influence on your local environment, because that then renders the centralized power structures obsolete.
Very famous doctor in England, very famous, he said children of the third world should be allowed to die because the third world population is growing too much and it's a threat to the planet, and therefore all healthcare should be withdrawn from the south for the health of the planet. So there is this idea that, you know, there's too many people, they should be allowed to die, because the whole thing is presented as a total biological phenomena out of control of consciousness, that we don't decide. A landless peasant was asked, why do you have such a large family? The landlord has only 2 kids, why do you have 8? And the peasant replied and said, because the landlord can buy the next tractor. All I can have is the next child. But, so you know, for the dispossessed, with no access to resources, no access to capital, the only thing they have is to sell their labor power. And then it makes total rational sense to have larger families. So it's not, higher populations are not a biological crisis of unthinking human beings who don't know what to do. Higher populations are an ecological symptom of resource equations out of balance.
I think overpopulation is far less of a problem than the consumption of resources. People in Australia consume 20 times as much as some of those people in Ethiopia, and so the real population problem lies in Australia rather than in the countries where people have a lot of children.
One way or another, we're facing a world of declining energy, and that inevitably over time that will lead to declining world population in some form. Not necessarily a catastrophic dial, but when the world is running on the renewable energy from the sun and its various embodied forms, then it might be able to support maybe 1 billion people, maybe 2 billion people.
Because there are 10 calories of hydrocarbon energy in every calorie of food consumed in an industrialized world, and the chart of human population growth has added, shows that 5 billion people exist today only since oil was first used. We use oil for fertilizers, pesticides, and oil is involved in flying grapes from Chile and moving food around the world in ridiculously unproductive ways.
In 2004, the UK exported 1.5 million tons of potatoes to Germany. Germany exported 1.5 million tons of potatoes to the UK.
There is no combination of energies anywhere, I repeat, that will replace what oil does.
What that means is that we have to learn to live in the way people did. Not exactly the same, but using the same design principles that every traditional sustainable society that existed before fossil fuels. These are inevitabilities that informed the beginnings of permaculture. So they are not just moral or lifestyle choices, but one way or another will be the way the world is in the future. So we may as well say, let's use our creativity and use the fossil fuels that we have and the technology we have to enable and positively build that future.
Genesis 1:28. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, Be fruitful, and multiply, and fill the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth.
What I'm trying to do, like many others, is to heal this terrible mistake that we made in our culture, around about the time of the scientific revolution, more or less, when we began to seriously believe that the earth is nothing more than a dead machine, that the whole earth is just there for us, that we humans are the only species with sentience, and that everything in the earth, well, the trees, the forests, the rocks, the minerals, are all there for us to exploit, that we've actually been placed here on this earth to use the scientific method and scientific rationality to exploit the earth merely for human benefit. So it's no surprise that after living for 400 years under the influence of this worldview, that we now have this phenomenal crisis. So we need an antidote to the mechanistic worldview. And in order to do that, we can look either to other cultures or dig down into the history of our own culture, like doing a sort of cultural archaeology, and look for ideas that could serve to become, once again, the appropriate metaphor. And the idea of anima mundi is the most suitable. Anima mundi means soul of the world in Latin. In Greek, the expression was psyche cosmou, the psyche of the cosmos. That was translated by somebody or other in the Roman world into anima mundi, the soul of the world. So we need to re-ensoul the world through telling stories, animated or animistic, I would say, scientific stories. To speak of rocks and atmosphere and carbon and sulfur and all the other things as sentient, as alive. If we don't take on this more soulful approach to the world will force it upon us. through wiping out our civilization. This current civilization, with its emphasis on suicidal growth, simply cannot continue.
Material progress, which has given man so many new conveniences, has at the same time speeded up the tempo of his life. But with the acceleration of his existence has come a nervous tension. Dissatisfaction and boredom with the daily routines of life are increasingly apparent. Mental illness and the breakdown of the individual personality have become the medical profession's great new problem.
Dr. Christine James speaks on psychology.
We need the bonding of a mother. At some stage in our life, we can't survive without it. And if something goes wrong with that, then almost certainly we are going to grow up being traumatized from not having that bonding. When that goes wrong, then something goes wrong in the mind. Something goes wrong in our place in the world. And I think that's what's happened. We have lost our sense of space with the planet. We've lost our ability to bond with the planet.
Dr. Mark Omidra speaks on integrative medicine.
It's not just an environmental problem, it's a public health problem. We must come to realise that we are connected intimately to the health of this planet, and also to the destructive processes that we inflict on this planet. A classic example being autoimmune problems or diseases, which are on the rise. Some experts suggest that autoimmune diseases have tripled or quadrupled in the last 20 years. What is an autoimmune disease? It's a disease where the cells in the body fail to recognise the host that serves them, that they embark on an attack on the very mother that sustains them. This is mirrored in the environment around us today. Another example is diabetes, which is on the rise in our culture, particularly juvenile diabetes. This has never been seen before in the numbers that it's being seen. It's often described as a disease of starvation in the midst of plenty. That is, that there is plenty of insulin inside the human body to feed cells, and yet that source of nourishment is not getting into those cells. You could juxtapose this on the macrocosm, where 15 million children in the developing world die a year of starvation. That is, that there is food there available for them, it's just not getting to them.
We need to realise that we are deeply embedded in the earth. Just as our gut microbes are to us, so are we to Gaia. We are embedded within this great round living creature, though I would say a sentient living creature.
This idea that we are some kind of scourge, some kind of cancer that's destroying the earth, is based on the same anthropocentrism as thinking that we're the crown of creation, that in fact we're part of the earth. Whatever we're doing to the earth is doing to herself.
I think there's a big fallacy in the belief that we connect with Gaia through good, because I think we also connect through evil. When you cut at the coal face, it's an absolute connection with the earth. When you subject your body to something like asbestos, isn't that the bonding of the body with the earth?
So the other way of seeing this is nothing we do, no matter how destructive it is to ourself or to other life, we are still not outside of the cage of Gaia.
It's as if in science we've just discovered a sixth kind of life, which is life at the level of a whole planet, a new kind of living being, a planetary being, and we are deeply immersed in her.
Well, the Gaia hypothesis was put forward by James Lovelock and Lynn Margulis to describe the way the Earth functions as if it's a living organism. Because a lot of its basic chemistry, especially of the atmosphere, is maintained within certain limits in a way that could not just be a random outcome of non-living processes. Now, they couldn't see any way that you could actually call the Earth as being alive in the sense that we think of an organism, but it had all the characteristics as if it was an organism. And they used the term Gaia because that was the Greek goddess of the earth, to just reflect that past peoples thought of the earth as being alive, and all traditional peoples actually thought this way. So if you ask traditional indigenous people and peasant people anywhere in the world, you explain the Gaia hypothesis to them, they say, yeah, so what? Obvious. But for scientific people, this was an enormous shock.
Gaia has this unpleasant connotation of animism. And you know, Gaia is a goddess, and you're not allowed to have gods and goddesses in science, even though scientists conveniently forget that all the other planets are named after gods and goddesses. But for some reason, we're not allowed to name the Earth after our own, very own Greek divinity of the Earth, ancient Greek divinity of the Earth. So Gaia is a dirty word in science.
In the beginning, the void, the darkness. Then light, then life. And from life came man, joining the caravan for the long, slow journey through a world of discovery, invention, exploration. His marks, his milestones, stretch out through the centuries. His footsteps echo down through the corridors of time. Time, July 1969 in Florida. The footsteps, the caravan quickened, the corridors shortened as man reached outside his world into another void.
Gaia, as we mentioned, was the original goddess of ancient Greece, and it wasn't until about 2000 BC that she was supplanted by masculine gods, gods of war and thunder. Now, Apollo was one of these. It's best exemplified by the Apollo moon programs. And you don't need to be Freud to see the symbolism of the Apollo rockets heading towards the feminine moon. And so the landing on the moons was like a high point of those Apollo values of reductionist and mechanist thinking. And indeed, both Carl Jung and James Lovelock see it as a defining moment in human history, when for the first time the collective unconscious, or Gaia, could see itself in its totality through the eyes of the astronauts, looking back from the moon to a whole planet Earth, a single super organism.
They first went there in 1969. They last left there in late 1972. Between the beginning and the conclusion, they came to feel, to dimly perceive what it was all about, to come to a perspective on the meaning of it all.
It's not just that we live in such a miraculous universe, but that if we really understand it, that's who we are, that we are that universe at the moment when it's become complex enough in the form of the human species to look over its own shoulder and see the incredible road that it has travelled, and the jaw of the universe drops in awe and wonder at the miracle of the whole thing.
If the human being does have a special purpose, that purpose is to bring consciousness itself to the earth. That is, to be conscious of consciousness, to that Gaia would be viewing or understanding herself through our consciousness.
I'm going to step off the land now. That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Thought I saw you, but it seems it was a trick of the light. Thought I knew you, but it seems was a trick of the mind.
What happens when light strikes an object is not what Newtonian physics says it is.